I usually don't interview people who are plugging books. Not that I'm against plugging books, but I've plugged mine enough, so... But usually they're all over the dial, which Carlotta Monti has been now for about 2 weeks. But I thought there would be some questions that people just didn't ask you. Is there one that you were dying for someone to ask you and they never did?
Well, I have a lot of stories in the book, but I have a funny story, sort of a poignant story, yet very funny. And I didn't write it in the book, but it was about a woman that lived next door to us when we lived on DeMille Drive. The woman behind us, her name was Mrs. Pruce, and she was an oil queen, and she looked like a madam, really. She had carrot-colored hair, and she drank a lot, and she had diamonds as big as quarters. Now, that's a fact. And she'd go down to the grocery store and pick out her own meats and her own chickens, and she'd tell the butcher they have to have a certain type of breast. And every day... This went on for, about 6 or 7 years. She'd send her cook over, and she wanted to meet Mr. Fields. And every other day or 2 or 3 times a week, she'd send him something to eat. So one day, after many years, this cook, Joe, came running into Mr. Fields' office, and he had a great big white hat on, and he took his hat off and put it over his heart, and he said, "Mr. Fields, I promise, Mr. Fields, I promise Mrs. Bruce, I bring you to her." And they had never met. So he had been drinking a little bit, or quite a bit, and the secretary got on one side, and I did on the other, and we had to go down I don't know how many stairs, and then up some more stairs, and she had a medieval castle. And we went into this dark, dark room. And it had red drapes and helmets and masks and swords on the wall. It was in red carpets. And there she was in about a $20,000 casket, all alone, and a couple of candles. And Joe went over to her, and he looked down and he said, "Mrs. Bruce, I keep my promise to you, Mrs. Bruce, Mr. Fields." And he turned around and he said, "Pleased to meet you." And we died laughing. I had to cover my face. I was so embarrassed. And I had to pretend I was crying. And he laughed so hard the tears rolled down his cheeks because he realized what he had done. "I'm pleased to meet you," you know, like that. And I think that was sort of sad and very funny at the time.
I think the funniest thing about W.C. Fields was really his attitude, you know, in movies and all the quotations and in your book. We didn't mention the title of the book is W.C. Fields and Me, and it's published by Prentice Hall. And was he really cynical? Because that was sort of the attitude I got from him.
Well, he pretended not to like children, but he was very nice to children when he was really with them, and... when my sister had a baby, he'd send her a layout, and he'd buy children toys. But when he was around them on the set, he tried to be very indifferent. Now, here's a very funny story that I have in my book. It's about Don Marlowe, and he was Porky.
In our gang.
In our gang. Mm-hmm. And he was a small 14, you know, a little chubby guy, and he full of energy and... I don't know, just full of hell almost. And he climbed over how many feet? About 20-foot fence, that little thing. And Fields was having an interview. And so, for a part in the picture. So then he said, "How did you get in, my boy?" He said, "I climbed over the fence." So he said, "I'll give you a part if you can mix a martini for me." So the little kid gets over there and he mixes this drink. And Phil said, "Now, my boy, I want you to run around the room 3 times. And if you don't spill a drop, the part is yours." So the little kid goes running around wildly in the room. and he doesn't spill a drop. Just, you act like a real pro. The part is yours. Run along, boy, run along. And he patted him on the head. And then the little boy was on the set helping him mix martinis. And he sort of used him as a stooge, you know, but just for laughs.
Did he ever talk to you about his own childhood?
Oh, yes. He had a very hard childhood. He worked on a wagon with his father. And in fact, I have a picture of that wagon with a big white horse. And he was so blonde, they called him Whitey. And he sold vegetables, and he juggled the fruits on this wagon. And his father used to sort of hit him now and then over the head with a cane. So one day he hit him a little too hard when he was 9, and he ran away. So that's the story he told me. I heard that story over many times.
Did he ever take anything seriously?
Oh, yes, he was very serious. He was self-educated, and he had his own dictionary. Every time he heard a word he didn't understand, he would write it down, look it up, and then he had his own dictionary that he made up, compiled. And he studied everything. He was a great one on history, and he studied English, and he listened to lectures, and he was crazy about Westbrook Pegler. That's before your time, too. And Walter Winchell was his... Oh, he was crazy about him. He used to go to the station with him all the time. And he was very serious about his work. He'd stay up all night trying to dream up what would make a person laugh. And then if I didn't laugh, he'd say, well, the Chinaman isn't laughing.
He called you out, the Chinaman.
Yes, yeah. Out it goes. So he wouldn't put an end.
How were you treated by his friends after he died?
Well, very, very well. Dave Chasen was very nice to me, and Gene Fowler was very nice, and the man that wrote The Fortunes and Follies of Fields, he was very nice. And they were all very nice to me. But I sort of, I don't know, I became sort of a recluse. I got a job at Technicolor, and my hours were so crazy that I just went to work and went home and went to school and studied painting and sort of lived a very quiet life.
Well, before you met W.C. Fields, you must have been ambitious for your own career.
Well, I worked a lot, but I wasn't very ambitious. As long as I was working, I was happy. And I had several parts in movies, like with Buster Crabbe. I played in a serial, and Boris Karloff, and that was another serial. That was before he became very famous with Frankenstein. And then I played with Fields in all of his pictures. I had small bits, but in The Man on the Flying Trapeze, I'm in it all the way through. And the thing I think that shows he wasn't too serious, maybe, is he put some wine in Baby Leroy's milk bottle to put him to sleep, and then they couldn't wake him up for the scene. I'll never forget that as long as I live.
Did it bother you that he really never wanted to get married?
No, I just didn't think about it. And I was very happy, and he was happy, and I knew he was married, and it just didn't bother me. I didn't think about it. And I think that if two people get along well, I think, well, there isn't anything wrong in living together. I really don't. And maybe some people do, but I know a lot of people that are married and they have girlfriends and vice versa. And I think to be a hypocrite is the worst sin that you can possibly commit.
I think the world is just about now getting around to your way of thinking.
Well, If it's right, it's all right. But what's wrong to live with someone that you can't stand, or because you have to support them, or... And, you know, he didn't give me any money, so no one can say that I was there because of money, because he just didn't give me any. When I wanted some money, I had to go out and sing.
What was he like when he'd been sober for quite a while during those periods when he was drying out?
I'm the one that made him quit drinking for about a year. and he was very sick, so there wasn't much conversation, and he was sort of like a convalescing, and it was a very hard period, because for a while there, he had pneumonia, and then I don't know if you'd say DTs, but he felt like he saw things, and he didn't remember things, and it took him about a year to get over that siege, and that was in 1937.
Did he ever discuss his drinking with you? I mean, the compulsive drinking?
Oh, no. It was just an accepted fact, and he never got drunk, and a lot of people don't believe that, but he was
had a glow.
A psychological drinker, and as long as he saw the drink in front of him, and he sipped on it, and then he'd throw some of it out. But he did consume 2 quarts a day, over 24 hours, you know.
I found it very interesting in your book, Miss Monte, that you, in a way, compared Mr. Fields with, for one, Ken Maynard, whose image to his public was that of a very, very clean liver, very outdoors man.
Well, Ken Maynard carried it a little too far. He wouldn't even kiss his leading lady. Incidentally, I worked in one of those little short westerns with him, and he was quite a character. He'd wear white gloves, and he didn't want to spoil the image. Oh, I better not say what I was going to, so...
Well, the reason I brought it up is because I met Ken Maynard a couple of years ago, and he's a total alcoholic.
Oh, just awful. He just...
Yeah. And a very unpleasant one, I might mention.
Very bad. It's too bad, isn't it?
Was he drinking then?
Yes, very much so. Now, not to mention Ken Maynard, but another very famous movie star, he married a very wealthy woman, this star, and he married her for the money, yet he didn't need it, but he wanted that security of the millions, and to me, and he just went with every girl he could find. So to me, that's being a big hypocrite. And just because they have a little paper and it's marriage and it makes it clean, it just doesn't. I think that, I don't know.
You were with Mr. Fields when he made My Little Chickadee with Mae West.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
Well, now, how did he get along with her?
Well, I know he liked her very much, but for some reason, his drinking really antagonized her. And one day, he was drinking in open, and so she had him put off his own set. And as he passed her, he said, "My little beauty, my little chickadee, adieu, adieu." And he tipped his hat and walked off the set. And she won't allow smoking or drinking in her presence.
Well, I interviewed Margaret Hamilton a few years ago, who was also in the film, and I asked her the same question. And she said, well, I had never seen any difficulty between them, actually. But she said, if you take a good look at that film, you'll find that they actually were in very few scenes together.
They were at sword's ends, because she wanted to do her lines, he wanted to do his way, and the director really had a headache during the whole filming.
Did he like Hollywood, the atmosphere and the politics and all that went on there?
Well, he loved California. He just loved the open spaces, and when he came out there, he had a 5-acre ranch. First, he lived at Toluca Lake, by the lake, and then he had this 5-acre ranch, and in California, they call 5 acres a ranch, and he loved to walk around the orange grove, and he was a real nature boy, really. He liked to play tennis and swim and go for rides and write, and he liked to be quiet, and he had very few friends. Well, if he had a dinner, 12 would be the most that he'd have for dinner. Very rarely, though, maybe 8.
I thought it was very nice also in your book that you mentioned he was a good lover.
I don't think that people should tell about their sex life. I think that's sort of a secret. Don't you think so?
Well, I think that much they should tell.
He was very continental, and he was really sweet. He'd pull my chair when I'd sit down for dinner, and if a nurse came into the room, they kept telling him, "Don't try to stand up." As raucous as he was on the screen, He was a real gentleman in real life. And they'd say, don't stand up. He'd almost die trying to stand up, you know. And when the doctors came in, he would want to be his old self, and he couldn't be.
Did he ever refer to his wife?
No. He rarely ever mentioned them. And he hadn't seen them in 45 years.
Even the son?
No, he hadn't seen Claude Jr. at all.
I believe he died recently.
He might have seen him once. He died 6 months ago. And, no, I think it's about 3 or 4 months ago he died. And he was trying to capitalize on his father's fame. And when Mr. Fields died, or Woody, as I call him, he tried to say he wrote his things for him, that he wrote the Edgar Bergen show, that he wrote the record that is out now by Decca, and he tried to, and he got on the Johnny Carson show, and he told how he was with his father. But I noticed that when Johnny Carson asked him a question, he couldn't answer it because he was not with him, and he did not own any of his things, and they had one big hassle all their lives by letter, and he was a lawyer, and he came out and he tied up the estate immediately, and it stayed in court 7 years, and they dissipated $1,300,000 just
in
like
attorney's
that.
Fees.
Well, no, keeping it in court is very hard. I think that they, Claude and Hattie, must have, well, they came out with $300,000 right away, and she several thousand widow's allowance. Now, to me, I don't think that that's right. She didn't contribute anything to his happiness in life, and I think that's hypocrisy. I don't believe that way. But I had no animosity toward her, none at all. He left me some furniture, and he had a phobia about ice boxes. And he had an ice box practically in every room, just like Nelson Eddy had a piano in every room. And he had an ice box that dated back to 1907. Well, he did not will the things to them, but they wanted all this. And they fought and hassled over it. Until I finally just said, oh, take anything you want. I just don't care. You know, so take the best icebox. I don't care. So I got one, and it lasted a few years. And I did get the safe. It was empty. He had left me $55,000 in it for that when he died. He'd always say, grab everything and run. The vultures are coming. The vultures will be here and pick my bones dry. And so I didn't do that, though, when he died. I just took him to the nearest parlor, should I say, where they embalm you. And then she came in and gave him a Catholic funeral. And then Edgar Bergen gave a eulogy about him being an atheist. And I described that all in my book. You know, and it's too lengthy to tell now about it. And then he had a third funeral, a spiritual funeral.
In one of the books, not yours, but in one of the books on Fields that I read, a number of years ago, it may have been the Fowler book, it said that when he was traveling very early on the vaudeville circuits, and I guess working for Ziegfeld, he used to open little bank accounts under fictitious names at various towns. And then sometimes he would forget what name he opened them under.
That's true. We found 48 bank books. 48. A little thing like this full of... Well, they were strewn around. Some were at the Security First National Bank and, under the name of Whip and Snade and Charlie Vogel and Uka Puka and crazy names. And, I think that he knew, but he did have, besides, I never did find out how much those bank books came to, but I do know that he had $1,300,000 to begin with, and he wanted a trust fund set up for me at $50 a week, and so there wasn't any money left. I got that for 7 or 8 years, or maybe 9 years. And I was working at Technicolor, so that was $50 a week pin money, and I was having a ball going to the mountains looking for uranium, hoping to get rich.
You never married?
No. Yes, I was married once when I was 16.
That was before Mr. Fields.
Yes. And I don't know why, but they were both very jealous. Fields was jealous, and this fellow was jealous. And Fred Niblo had seen me dance at the Hollywood Bowl. My teacher, Madame De Silva, gave a recital there. And he wanted me for Ben-Hur. In the meantime, my husband locked me in a closet and left me there all day long, and I think that that did something to me. I've always been sort of afraid, and I have claustrophobia, too. It's claustrophobia, isn't it?
You say, too, because Mr. Fields had it also.
He had it terribly. He had to have space. I have to have space now, too. I try not to let it bother me, but I have to have a flat where I go in a front door and I must have a back door so I can run out the back door. And I think that being locked up like that all day was very harrowing at the time. Now I look back and it's very funny. So do you know what I did to my husband? He was a big eater, and he was an old man, 30 years old. Well, a little girl, 16, you know, you always think a man 30 is old. Isn't that right?
Yes.
So
yes.
He was a big eater, and he was Italian, and $40 in those days could buy so many groceries. I bought $40 worth of groceries, put it in the apartment, and I said, I'm going to Hollywood. Never saw him again. Never. I paid for the divorce and got the thing annulled.
Well, he was what? He was 14 years older than you were. And
he must have been...
He was 30.
Well, maybe he was older. He looked very old to me. So. And my folks wanted me to get married because I was dancing.
And Mr. Fields was 28 years older.
Mm-hmm. I always liked older men.
Obviously, yeah.
When I was very young, I liked old men. And when I got older, I liked younger fellows.
Well, you must have seen Mr. Fields in movies long before you met him.
Well, he made all of the movies, practically. I was with him when he made all those movies.
But I meant you would have seen him on the screen before you met him.
Yes, I saw those little shorts.
Were you a fan?
Well, no, I didn't pay much attention. I wasn't really a fan. I liked him when I saw him and I did the publicity stills with him, and then when the romance started.
But it was his manner rather than his humor.
Yes, he was. It was just him. You know how you meet someone right away and you have rapport?
Yes.
And you just sort of hit it off.
If you're lucky, yeah.
And we were both Capricorns. I sort of think that was something. We liked the same things. And we did a lot of things together, and we had a lot of fun. And he had very interesting people around. And it was glamorous. It was something I never had in my life. And I liked him very much. In fact, I loved him. He gave me, this is terrible, he gave me $100 for Christmas, and he was a multimillionaire. He had a lot more money when I met him than he had when he died, because he lived so lavishly. And I'd go out and spend the money on him. I'd buy him something that I knew he'd like. I even had a maid bed for him. And it cost me $200.
Why would you give him a bed? Surely he had a bed.
Because he just didn't buy himself a proper bed, and it was terrible. It was hard, and he put straw in the mattress. He said it was good for his back. And so I went out, and I had a bed made. Am I allowed to say the name of the company?
Say anything you want, sure.
Well, I consider Beautyrest Simmons. There's something about that bed that hugs your body. And I had it made a specific, not too hard, not too soft, and not medium, if you know. And I still have the bed. It looks like new, and I get in it now, and it's heaven. I haven't slept in it in 19 years. I just started sleeping in it. And it just... beautiful. You'd say, oh, it's wonderful. And that's what he did. The first thing he got in that bed, he said, oh, Oh, it's marvelous. I'll tell you something funny I haven't told anybody about Fields. Well, I think it's in the book. He slept with his feet out all the time.
How do you mean out? Out from under the covers?
Absolutely. It could be freezing cold, and his feet would be sticking out. He couldn't.
Is that unusual?
Well,
so do I.
Oh, do you really?
Yes.
Well, his story was that it went back to his early days, that he never had any covers on his feet, and that was a custom for him. And I used to try to get hot water bottles for his feet when he was sick, and he wouldn't stand for it. Do you sleep like that?
Yes, but it wasn't that. I think it with me, it was just another variation of claustrophobia. I don't like to be
tidy.
Enclosed, no, by anything.
You don't like...
Even in bed.
You don't like to be tied down by a woman?
I've never been tied down by a woman.
Okay.
Or a man either, for that matter.
Well, you don't know what you've missed, but I'm really more so
really?
That.
Really?
No.
Maybe I should look into it.
You know what? I think if you've had it once...
go on.
The second time, well... I don't know. I better not say what I'm thinking.
I think you said what you were thinking. Did he help you at all with your career, though? I know he gave you parts in his pictures.
Absolutely not. You should see me in The Man in the Flying Trapeze. The clothes he made me wear. He just didn't want me to look attractive. And he was so jealous that when I'd walk a on the lot at Paramount, I had made many films there, and I knew everybody. And he called fellas gigolos all the time. And one time, this wonderful, famous director, Henry Hathaway. He was so handsome when he was young. I haven't seen him for years, so I can only remember him as this skinny boy. We're going down the lot, and I had just started to go with Woody. And I said, "Hi, how are you, Henry? Who's that gigolo?" I said, "Oh, he's the director. I don't want you talking to anyone when you're with me." And I said, "Okay." So I got to the point where I walked on the lot with my eyes down because it was embarrassing. And I was nervous. And I quit going to the studio with him because it was so awful. He'd want me to sit on a chair all day. So talking about claustrophobia, you'd have it if you had some woman to tell you to sit in a chair all day, wouldn't you?
I'm sure, yes.
Wouldn't you go crazy?
Yes, I would.
I wanted to run away. Oh, I have something to tell you. Speaking of this money, the $55,000, when he was with Chasen Sanborn and Charlie McCarthy, that was 1937, he had this money in a safe on DeMille Drive. And that was the last home that we lived in. And there wasn't one servant in the house this Sunday. So he said to me, "Chinaman, I want you to go and sit in front of the house. I want you to watch that money. Someone might come in and grab it." So I said to myself, "I'm not about to go and sit in front of that house today. I'm going to Beverly Hills. My girlfriend's giving a big party, so I'm going." So I went up there, and he got very nervous and very upset. He said to his agent, Charlie Byer, "Charlie, go up and see what that witch is doing." And he went up there, and he couldn't find me. And he said, before he went, he said to Charlie, "She's already in Mexico City. I can see her spending all that dough on all those Mexicans and those Mexican..." I can't say the word.
Bastards. You can say
bastards.
Can
he say bastard here?
Sure. Say it.
Mexican bastards. So I'll have her extradited. I'll have her extradited. And this is just before the thing's going on. So I timed it and went back just before he went on. And Charlie Byer was going in at the NBC lot in Hollywood, you know, Sunset and Vine. And I looked at Charlie and I said, oh, I know. You were up there following me because he used to have me followed and everything. I said, I went to a party. Don't make him unhappy. I had a wonderful time. Just tell him that you saw me sitting up there watching the money. So that was the end of that story, but it was really funny. He had me extradited. He had me stealing the money, spending it. And you know what? I really should have taken the money and put it in the bank and say, now look, here I am, but there's the money. I'm going to keep it.
I think one of the chief reason that young people like Mr. Fields so much, and I don't know if you go to his festivals, there's one in town right now, but it's full of young people who were born even before after he died, is that W.C. Fields to them and to me really was one of the great rebels. How do you think he'd have liked today? It's a whole new ball game.
Well, if he would have lived, he'd be 93 years old now, so I don't know what his reaction would be now. But I imagine he'd go along with still being a rebel because he liked the idea. He always was for, not that the young people are the underdogs, but he was for the underdog, and that's the way he created
for
himself.
For little people. Yes. He always played
always,
little people.
Yes, but he was a very common, ordinary type of man. And he was good-hearted. He used to help actors out that were in trouble. And he helped a very famous comedian out once by sending him $500 for rent and for an electric bill. And I made the check out, and Sam Hardy delivered it. And I wouldn't mention his name because his wife is still living. He's very famous. And he never even thanked him, and that sort of put a crimp in things. He never was big-hearted after that. And he was 64 years old when that happened, I remember. And he said, I'll never help another actor as long as I live.
Carla DeMonte has been my guest today, and we've been discussing her book, which is delightful, and it's full of pictures. And it's available now, and it's published by Prentice Hall. It's called W.C. Fields and Me, and you can get it anywhere. It's out now, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
And she's currently making the rounds and was kind enough to stop by today. So I want to thank Carla DeMonte and Prentice Hall for making her available, and you for listening. This is Richard Lamparsky. Until next week, I hope you all have a very nice evening.